Tonight's lecture is dedicated to the memory of Batya Bat Yitzchak, the daughter of Yitzchak and Aviva Ernst. And may her memory be a blessing to the family, and may her neshama have an aliyah. Tonight's lecture concerns itself with two of the great people of the second generation of Amoroim. When I spoke to you about Rabba and Rav Yosef, that was the third generation of Amoroim. This is a generation earlier. So again, the first generation of Amoroim is Rav and Shmuel, are the main figures. In the second generation of Amoroim, we had Rav Huna and Rav Chisda, who were the successors to Rav. Rav Nachman and Rav Sheshes are, to a certain extent, the successors to Shmuel because they lived in Nahar Doa. They lived in Shmuel's town, even though neither of them occupied the position that Shmuel did. Again, as I discussed with you last night, that Shmuel was this special person, the all-around great man in every respect, and that after his death, Nahar Doa declined. But in this second generation, Rav Nachman and Rav Sheshes are still in Nahar Doa. Now, Rav Nachman and Rav Sheshes are both very wealthy and powerful people. But they are, as one always finds with human beings, there are major differences between them, not just in halakha, but also in personality and in world outlook, and how they viewed the community that they lived in. Rav Nachman married the daughter of the head of the exile, of the Reish Gelusa. And she's one of the famous women in the Talmud. Yilta is her name. And she is quoted often in the Talmud. And she engaged in lively debate with many of the great men of the Talmud. She is not being the daughter of the exilarch and being the daughter of a very powerful person. So one can imagine that she was not that reticent about expressing her opinion. And we find that in her relationship with her husband as well, that she's a formidable person and mentioned many times in the Talmud. One of her most famous statements in the Talmud is that everything that the Torah forbade, it allowed us in a different form. She said certain foods which are forbidden, but you can make them in a kosher form and they taste the same. And so today we survive to see kosher sushi and kosher shrimp imitated and parva ice cream and all of the other benefits of modern society that we have in our time. So she said everything that was made forbidden was allowed in a different form. And by that she meant that the Torah never assert anything. The Torah never said something is wrong per se. But rather all of these are rules and decrees that the Lord imposed upon us. So therefore that's why this can be forbidden and practically the same thing can be permitted. And we find her often in the Talmud, her comments are very, very striking. Now, her father was Rav Ukva, who was, according to most of the commentators, most of the scholars of the Talmud, who was the Reish Gelusa himself. There is a minority opinion that says he was the brother of the Reish Gelusa. But we find that when the Talmud refers to Rav Nachman, They always call him Chasna de Beinasiya, the son-in-law of the prince, the son-in-law of the exile. And that phrase, Chasna de Beinasiya, has remained in Jewish life so that if somebody is the son-in-law of a famous Hasidic Rebbe, or he's the son-in-law of a Rosh Yeshiva, so then the phrase Chasna de Beinasiya is still employed to identify the fact that he married the daughter of this great and noble person. Now, Rav Nachman, his name is Rav Nachman Bar Yaakov. In the Talmud, we have a number of Rav Nachman. The Talmud is confusing in the sense that there are a lot of people with the same names, and you never know which one is talking. And therefore, that's why these lectures are so important. So, Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak, for instance, appears in the Talmud very often. He's already third, almost fourth century, fourth generation Amoraim. But this is Rav Nachman Bar Yaakov. And Rav Nachman Bar Yaakov is second generation Amoraim. And usually in the Gemara, when it only says Rav Nachman and does not identify who his father was, we are speaking about Rav Nachman Bar Yaakov. Rav Nachman Bar Yaakov is an expert in monetary matters. And he was the chief judge in Nahar Doeh. And being the chief judge, we therefore decide in matters that pertain to monetary matters that the halacha will be like Rav Nachman over the opinion of his colleague Rav Sheshes. But in matters of ritual and in matters of what is permitted and what is not permitted, matters of kashrus, etc., there we follow Rav Sheshes and not Rav Nachman. Now we find this same difference by Rav and Shmuel, that in matters of ritual we follow Rav, and in matters of monetary decisions, damages, torts, etc., we follow the opinion of Shmuel. So there is such a dividing line in the Gemara. And it seems that the dividing line naturally is based upon the person's expertise. Rav Nachman is an expert. If you don't believe him, he tells you so, as we'll see in a minute. Rav Nachman is not reticent about saying who he is. And therefore, he is the chief of the chief judge in Nahar Doeh. And he is the person to which all of these matters are referred to. Rav Nachman is very, he's a composite of opposites. And I'll spend a few minutes to discuss that. On one hand, Rav Nachman is assertive. He is very proud of his accomplishments. He's not embarrassed to say things. He's very strong. On the other hand, he is almost someone who doesn't have self-confidence, who is constantly undermining himself and minimizing himself. And there are many, many opinions by the commentators as to this personality of Rav Nachman, what drives him here. So, for instance, they once told him a halacha in the name of Rabbi Yochanan. So Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish are living in the land of Israel, in Tiberias, while Rav Nachman and Rav Sheshes are living in Babylonia in Nahar Doeh. I mentioned already last night that the competition between the land of Israel and Babylonia was intense. Sometimes it was even personal. And because of that, therefore, they once mentioned him that he said a halacha, and they told him, well, Rabbi Yochanan doesn't agree with you. Rabbi Yochanan in Eretz Israel It says the opposite. And he said, even if Rabbi Yochanan stood here in front of me, I wouldn't agree with him. In other words, you're telling me what he said in Eretz Yisrael, I don't know, but even if he was here in front of me, I wouldn't agree with him. I wouldn't give in on it. Rabbi Yochanan had patriots amongst his students. And when the words of Rav Nachman reached Rav Ami, who was one of the main students of Rabbi Yochanan, he was very hurt thereby. And he said, how could that be that he had such an attitude towards Rabbi Yochanan? So we already see that there are, amongst the rabbis, there are those who feel that Rav Nachman pushes the envelope too far. We find that, for instance, somebody came before him, a great rabbi, and said, you know, the rule that you postulated was incorrect, etc. Rabbi Yochanan is correct. And he said, what are you talking about? He said, Ani Dayan Vahulo Dayan. I'm the judge. He's not a judge. Now, what does that mean? I'm the judge and he's not a judge. So that's not a question only of haughtiness or saying, look how great I am and he isn't that great. What he means here is, and we have a rule, that in a Bet Din, all things being equal, which they never are, but all things being equal, or in a question of halakha that's posed to a rabbi, there is heavenly intervention to allow that rabbi or the judge or the Bet Din to come to a correct decision. That's if the Bet Din is not corrupt, if it's truly searching for the correct way, so then God helps them. And all questions that come before a rabbi are also of the same nature. So there are two famous rabbinic stories that I want to share with you. In the 13th century, really the beginning of the 14th century, there's a rabbi, Rabbi Yisroel Isserlin, who's a rabbi in Vienna, in Bohemia. Austria, Vienna, Prague, in that area. And he wrote a book called Trumas HaDeshen. Now the word deshen in Hebrew means the ashes. Trumas HaDeshen means to clean off the ashes, which is what the Kohanim did every morning in the Beit HaMikdash. But the word Deshen, the numerical value of the word Deshen is 354. The Shin is 300, the Nun is 50, and the Dalet is 4. Now there are 354 days in the lunar year, and we have a lunar year. So this year, for instance, 5766 has exactly 354 days. There are sometimes we have 355, 356, and then when we have a leap year, it goes up to the 380s. But this year is exactly a lunar year, 354 days. So his sefer was meant that you took one of the questions that was posed to him, and one of the answer that he gave to that question, which is what the book is 354 questions and answers. And, you know, an apple a day keeps the doctor away. If every day you study one of the questions and the answers, so within a year, you become a great Torah scholar. This book became the basis of Ashkenazic Psak Halacha, the basis later his descendant, Reb Moshe Isserlish, of the Ramah in Krakow, who is the co-author of the Shulchan Aruch, together with Rabbi Yosef Karo. Everything is based on the Trumas HaDeshen. Comes along the Shach, Reb Shabsai Cohen, in the 1630s, 40s, 50s. And he has a great commentary to Yoredeya, to the Shulchan Aruch, and he has a great commentary to Choshen Mishpat, the laws of money, also in the Shulchan Aruch. And he writes there, he says, I don't know if we really can rely on the decisions of the Truma Sadeshin of Rabbi Yisroel Liserlin. Because he said, though he not only made up the answers, he made up the questions. So the questions are not real. If the questions are not real, then heaven doesn't bother to have anything to do with it. And therefore, his answers are only human answers, so to speak. And when it comes to deciding halakha, there is an element beyond the human mind, which helps us arrive at the correct decision. So he said, I don't know whether we should rely on this great book, even though it's been relied on for 300 years before him, simply because of the fact that he says that not only did he make up the answers, he made up the questions as well. They used to say that the difference between the bar exam for lawyers and the CPA exam for accountants is that every year in the CPA exam, they change the questions. And every year in the bar exam, they change the answers. Being an old lawyer, I can tell you how true that is. That's one story, the Shach and the Truma Sadeshin. The second story is a story told about Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan, the Rav in Kovne, that once he had a Din Torah, and people hired, people came before him, and witnesses, etc., and he decided the Din Torah in favor of Mr. Cohen over Mr. Goldberg. Mr. Goldberg didn't take that very well. He felt that Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan had made a mistake. So he went and he hired actors to act out the Din Torah in front of another great Rav. And they said exactly, the transcript of the Din Torah, nobody added a word, etc. And the other Rav heard it, and he decided for Mr. Cohen, for Mr. Goldberg instead of for Mr. Cohen. So they went back to Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan, and they said to him, you see that the other great Rav disagrees with you? So he said, that doesn't count because that wasn't a real Din Torah. That was actors only portraying, and therefore from heaven they didn't help him. But here it was a real Din Torah, and therefore there is what is called in the language of the Talmud, Siyata Dishmaya, the help of heaven. So when Reb Nachman Bar Yaakov says, I'm a Dayan and you're not a Dayan, he is saying, listen, I'm dealing with real cases. You're dealing with theory. You're dealing with logic, right? So you disagree with me. But I have real live people in front of me. When you have real live people in front of me, so then, so to speak, heaven is also interested in the outcome and how you're going to judge the matter. And therefore, he said, I really don't care what you say. Because ani dayan, I am the judge, umar eino dayan, and you are not the judge. So it's not a matter of hubris. See, many of the scholars in the last two centuries have taken upon, because of the agenda of the Haskalah, and the agenda of those who came to dismantle Jewish tradition and to create the new Jew that has never arrived, but in the process destroying the old Jew. So many of them have taken these types of statements to show that these weren't great people. Look at the arrogance of the man to say, I'm the judge, I don't care. But that stems from their own ignorance of what lies behind the statement. They didn't buy this tape. What lies behind the statement is I'm the judge, and therefore there is a matter of heavenly intervention here, and therefore I think that you should rely upon me rather than rely upon the statement of the other rabbi, no matter how great he may be and no matter how learned he may be, but he is talking in theory and I'm talking about real people who are standing here before me. And that's an important rule, that all questions have to be answered to people. They are not answered in the abstract. Unfortunately, in our time, we have many, many things answered in the abstract. We have books written that way, but you're really talking to people. Or the Torah, the halacha talks to people. And therefore, you can even have different answers from the same rabbi, but to two different people under different circumstances. We will answer a question in kashrus for a person who is very wealthy in a much different fashion than we'll answer that same question to a person who is short on money. Or if the question arises Friday morning and you have to cook the chicken for Shabbos and there are no other chickens, So then we'll answer the question one way. Of course, there are parameters. I mean, you can't just ignore her, but we will try to be more lenient than if you ask the question on Monday. Because on Monday, you don't need the chicken for Shabbos, right? Or the classic case in the Gemara is that your mother-in-law is coming for supper. So maybe the rabbis didn't care what you fed her anyway, but there also we will answer, or if you have guests. So the halacha looks at the people who are asking the question. They don't look at it only in the abstract. How does the question exist? Is it kosher or isn't it kosher? So usually the answer is it all depends. It depends on many circumstances. Now there are things that are cut and dried, right? That are obvious that it's either kosher or not kosher, but most of halacha, like most of life, is not black and white. It's gray. It's in the middle somewhere. And the genius of the poskim, the genius of the great people of halacha, is to be able to decide these matters that are not cut and dried and to come to conclusions. The Gemara says, the famous Gemara, that when Rav Yitzchak was a great fan of Rav Nachman, he held from him greatly. And therefore, Rav Nachman, when he left him, asked him, please give me a blessing, Yevorcheini. Please give me a blessing. Now, that throughout the Talmud, we find that people always ask for blessings. Say a good word on me. And it is about Rav Nachman that the great blessing that, in fact, has been put to music in the Jewish world, comes into being because he gives him the example of the tree. That the man finds a tree in the middle of the desert, and underneath the tree there's a spring of water, and he has fruit to eat from the tree. And he says, what shall I bless you with, the tree, that you should have beautiful leaves? You have beautiful leaves. You should have fruit. You have fruit. That there should be water under you. You have water under you. What blessing can I give you? The only blessing I can give you is that those trees that come from you should be like you. And he said, that's the blessing that was given to Rav Nachman. He said, how shall I bless you? You're a Torah genius, you're a Torah genius. You're wealthy, you're wealthy. You have children, you have children. You have everything. So then what blessing can I give you is that those who come from you should resemble you. Which, if you think about it, is probably the ultimate blessing. Because it's the only thing that survives us. Nothing else really accompanies us. All right, so therefore, Rav Nachman is this strong and great person. However, we find, he says, for instance, as I said yesterday on Rav Yosef, he says the same thing about himself. He says, if it were not for the Torah, there are a lot of Nachmans in the street. A lot of people named Nachman. So he said, I'm not the greatest. I'm only the greatest because of the fact that there was Torah. And then he says something which also is astounding. The Talmud says that when this and this great man died, so then there were no more people who were yirei chet, who were afraid of sin. So Rabbi Nachman said, don't say that, I'm still here. I'm still afraid. Commentators attempt to deal with that, because it sounds to be a little strange. He also said about himself, he says, if Mashiach is alive in this generation, I'm the Mashiach. So there again, the rabbis say that what he really meant is that there is no Mashiach in this generation. And that was his way of phrasing it. But in any event, you see an aggressive stature of the person, right? He asserts himself very, very strong. However, we find an opposite part to the character. The Gemara says that when Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yecheskel came before Rav Nachman for a din Torah, so Rabbi Yehuda bar Yecheskel is the head of the yeshiva in Pumpedisa, and he has a great reputation, and he's a great scholar. And so he comes before Rav Nachman. So Rav Nachman says, Odom godol atov, ani eni mevin afilu mata asosoch. You're such a great man, you're so much greater than I am. I don't even understand your conversation. Why are you coming before me for the din Torah? Meaning I'm not worthy. Yilta, his wife, who overhears the conversation, Yilta's always present, you know, she's not in the kitchen. She says, you better take this din Torah and paskin, because otherwise he'll say that you're an amoritz, that you don't know anything. And therefore, don't be so subservient. And because of that, takes the din Torah, and he even against Rav Yehuda. We'll find that he and Rav Yehuda have other clashes, so to speak. He invites Rav Yehuda to eat at his house, and Rav Yehuda gives him 15 reasons why not. And when he comes to eat, he says, why do you do this, and why do you do that, and this is wrong, and that's wrong. And we find Rav Nachman doesn't answer him. And the Mefarshim say because of the fact that she was dead already. Yilta was no longer alive, his wife is no longer alive, and therefore the person that gave him the strength, the self-confidence wasn't around, and therefore we find him to be very meek towards the end of his life, and that he accepts criticism from everyone and he does not answer, he doesn't defend himself. Now we find also that after giving a certain lecture in the synagogue in Ardoya that hundreds if not thousands of people heard, the next day he sent an amora to get up in the synagogue again and to say that Rav Nachman announces that everything that he said yesterday was wrong and that he retracts it. It was incorrect. So sometimes he is he's lacking in confidence almost. And so it's a very complex person, one of the greatest men in the Talmud. But the Talmud gives us different facets of him and different opinions, right? He mentions many times how he fears the angel of death. And even though he lived a long life, he lived to 80, the Talmud says, but he's always in terror of the angel of death. And we find the Gemara tells us a deathbed scene that Rava is present. Rava is from the next generation of Abaya and Rava. So that's already the fourth generation. But Rava, Rav Nachman, since he lived a long time, he was 80 years old, he had Talmidim not only in the third generation, but in the fourth generation as well. And he's in extremis, he's lying on his deathbed, and he tells Rava to tell the angel of death that he should not give him a hard death. Should not cause him pain. He should take him easily. So Rava says to him, I should tell him. You're so much greater than I am. You tell him. In other words, I'm the student and you're the Rebbe. What do you mean I should tell him? And he answers him and he said that people on the deathbed, there is no Adam Godel. There is no greatness anymore. The angel of death respects no one. You're alive yet, you're going to live, maybe he'll listen to you. Rava has a dream. In the dream, he sees Rav Nachman comes back to him. So Rava says to him, what was death like? So he said, it was like taking a hair out of milk. That the neshama leaving the body is as smooth as removing a hair from milk. So Rava said to him, if that's the case, would you come back in this world again if you had a chance? And Rav Nachman says to him, no, he said, because the fact that people realize that they're mortal weighs upon them their entire life. And therefore, he said, it's not worth it. So we see from this story exactly how, the psychology that Rav Nachman had. And as I mentioned, he was 80 years old when he died. Now, Rav Nachman had a colleague and a companion who, again, as I mentioned yesterday, there are people that march together through the Talmud, that whenever you find one, you'll find the other. And the other one is Rav Sheshes. Now, Sheshes is a funny name. It means sixth. So we don't know why they were, usually, many of the Forshim say because it was the sixth child. Some say it was the sixth son. Others say that it has nothing to do with the word Shisha at all, but that it should be pronounced Seisis, because there are no dots in the Gemara. There's no punctuation. You don't know how to pronounce. I'm sure that if the Amoraim came back and heard the way the Lithuanians or the Hungarians pronounced their names, they would, they wouldn't quite go for it. But it means it could be that it's Seisus, meaning to rejoice, that like sauce, and that was a name that was given to children that either were born miraculously or a man had a lot of girls and then they finally had a boy, or those types of situations when one wanted to express special joy at the birth of a child. In any event, Rav Sheshes is the companion of Rav Nachman Bar Yaakov. And Rav Sheshes is the strong man. The Talmud calls him Ish Koshek HaBarzel, a man hard as iron, made of iron. And to a certain extent, they all were afraid of him. The Gemara says an interesting thing, that when he met Rav Chisda, and Rav Chisda was the great Rosh Yeshiva in Sura, the successor to Rav Huna, who was the successor to Rav. So Rav Chisda trembled when he met him because he was so afraid of Rav Sheshes' knowledge and of his strong opinions and of the fact that he did not suffer opposition very easily. And so Rav Sheshes is a completely different personality of Rav Nachman. We do not find that he should have self-doubt. We don't find that he withdraws from answering. He and the Talmud calls him Ish Kosha Kabarzel, right? The person that's as strong as iron, right? He's the strong man who doesn't give in to anyone. However, there's always however in life. He lost his eyesight at a relatively early age. So he's the great Rav Sheshes, even though he can't see. And he teaches, and he has Talmidim as disciples, but he cannot see. But because he cannot see physically, the Talmud ascribes to him the fact that spiritually he can see far greater than others. And we find, for instance, the Gemara says that he once went to welcome the king. It was the custom of all of the great rabbis that when the king came, so they went out to meet him. That was a custom in Eastern Europe as well, in Europe, throughout the world. And in fact, the custom was to take the Sifrei Torah and stand with the Sifrei Torah in honor of the king. There are many, many stories regarding this. Again, since everybody loves stories, I'll tell you two of them. One is that the Emperor Franz Joseph of the Austro-Hungarian Empire once visited Bratislava, Presburg, the town of the Chasam Sofer and his son, who was the successor, the Ktav Sofer. And the king made the visit on a Shabbat. So everybody went out, so the Jews lined up, and the Rav led the delegation, the Ktav Sofer, and the emperor, who was a mild anti-Semite, and therefore he was considered to be a friend of the Jews, compared to the Tsar and the Kaiser, who were overt anti-Semites. So the king, knowing that it was Shabbat, took out a cigar from his pocket, and he said, "I heard that the Rabbiner likes to smoke cigars. The emperor wants to present the Rabbiner with a cigar." So the Ktav Sofer took the cigar and put it in his pocket. So the emperor said to him, "Herr Rabbiner, the emperor gives you a cigar, and you won't smoke it? It's Shabbat." So the Ktav Sofer said to him, "My dear emperor, the emperor's cigar should go up in smoke and ashes." And he said, "Eine kluge Jude," one smart Jew. He let him off. The second story, which is really to me a very moving story, is if you go to visit President Katzav in the Maon of the Nasi in the President's house in Yerushalayim, in Yerushalayim on Rehov Jabotinsky. So there's an enormous room, a very big room, and that's the reception room where the President of Israel receives the ambassadors that present their credentials from all of the foreign countries to show that they're ambassadors to the State of Israel. The room is, it's got a great Chagall tapestry to it. It's got a beautiful carpet. There's no furniture except in the corner of the room, there's a little Oren Kodesh with a small Sefer Torah in it. And the story is that the Russian Tsar in 1903 or 1904 visited the Jewish little town of Bobruisk in Lithuania. And the custom amongst Jews was to present a Sefer Torah to the leader, to the king, etc. That's why, for instance, Weizmann gave Harry Truman a Sefer Torah when he visited him in 1949. Truman, the Missouri farmer that he was, He took the Torah and he said, gee, I always wanted one of these. And the Sefer Torah today is in the Truman Library in Independence, Missouri, in its own glass case, with great respect. And it's they gave the Tsar this little Sefer Torah in the Oren Kodesh. Came the revolution in 1917, that the communists and the Bolsheviks needed money. So they sold off many of the Tsar's treasures on the world market. One of the things they sold off was this Sefer Torah and the Ark that it contained. In the 1930s, the Sefer Torah and the Ark are in an antique, in the window of an antique shop in London. A Jew by the name of Williams, Orthodox Jew, walks by and sees it. So he says, how can it be that the Sefer Torah should be in the window? He goes in and he buys it. In 1973, when Zalman Shazar was the president of the State of Israel, so they built the president's house in the state on Rehov Jabotinsky, this beautiful house. So he presented it to the president as a gift. And Shazar, who was a very traditional Jew, Chabad Chosid, said, I'm going to put it into this room so that every foreign dignitary that comes to the president of the State of Israel to present his credentials, the Sefer Torah of Bobrovsk, will be the witness to the fact that there is a Jewish state. So Chazal say, Akol tzrichim l'mazel afilu Sefer Torah shebeheichol. Everything needs mazel in this world, even a Sefer Torah needs mazel. And this is the mazel of this Sefer Torah. The other Sefer Torah, Nebuch, ended up being sandals and all sorts of things. And here it is in its exalted positions. In any event, Rav Sheshes goes to greet the king. A Christian is standing, so the Talmud always has conversations with the early Christians who were really out to get the Jews. So the Christian says to him, I hear the band playing. The king is coming. Avshesha says, no, he's not coming. He's not here yet. Then you hear the drums of the honor guard. He said, now he's coming. Avshesha said, no, he's not coming yet. And then he says, I hear great rustling, mustering of arms. It must be that the king is coming. Avshesha said, no, he's not coming. And then there's dead silence. And then there's just like a small little sound. And Avshesha said, now he's coming. So the Christian said to him, but you're blind. How did you know? So he said, the kingdom on this earth represents in a small fashion the kingdom in heaven. And God said to the prophet Elijah that I do not come in the wind and I don't come in the earthquake and I don't come in the noise. Cold momodako, the little silent little voice, that's where you'll find me. So he said, so that's how I knew. We find another conversation with a Christian that Rav Sheshes blessed the king. So he said, well, how can you bless the king? You can't even see him. And Rav Sheshe said, I always bless the king of all kings whom I cannot ever see. But Rav Sheshe gave him a look, the Gemara says, and the look put him away, even though the look came from sightless eyes. So Rav Sheshe in the Talmud is given supernatural powers. Either you don't want him to look at you, even though he can't see you. Because he's a ish kosher kabarzel, right? He brooks no compromises. He doesn't make excuses for people. And because of that, therefore, people Well, can I tell you, there's a famous legend that the Arizal, the great Rabbi Yitzchak Luria, could tell by looking at a person what sins that person had. So nobody ever went to see him. Because who wants that experience, right? So Rav Sheshis is a little like that, even though he is sightless. To the extent that the Talmud says that he saw the Malach HaMoves, the angel of death, came to take him, and he was walking in the marketplace. So he said to the angel of death, he said, "What, am I going to die in the street like a behemoth? You'll come to my house later." The Gemara Moed Kot. So again, you know, you see that strength of character. I mean, I don't know what word to use, right? I mean, like Rav Nachman is terrified of the angel of death, and he, you know, he tells him, "Not here. You know, you'll come later. You know, make an appointment." The Gemara says that he is invited to eat in the house of the Resh Gelusa. We don't know whether this Resh Gelusa, the exile arch, is the father-in-law of Rav Nachman, or it's a different one. It may be the successor already. He comes to the house and he says he can't eat here. It's not kosher. Well, in today's world, we would understand that. But in Rav Sheshis's world, what do you mean you can't eat by the exile arch? I mean, well, so he said, "I want you to know that you have servants in the kitchen who are not observant of the laws and have made your food not kosher." So he said, "It can't be." Not that he said, "It can't be." He said, "You can't see. How do you know?" So he said, "Investigate." And the Talmud said they investigated and they found that that was true, that the servants had served meat that was not kosher. And Rav Sheshis, not seeing, saw, while those who could see didn't see. And Talmud tells us that the servants wanted to get even with him, so they placed a small bone in the portion of food that he was eating, hoping that he would choke on it. And again, he felt the food before he ate it. He found the bone, he threw it away. So the Talmud sees Rav Sheshis as a balanes, somebody who has supernatural qualities to him, a person that it's a miracle maker, so to speak, and therefore the Talmud doesn't want to mess with him. People don't want to disagree with him because of the fact that he has this quality of the Talmud also says that he's walking on the road, and people planted a pit in front of him, and they covered it up with a mat so that you didn't see the pit. And he senses something, so he says to his servant, he said, "Call over a Jewish child from the cheder." And this we find in the Gemara many times. When you wanted to know something, they would call over a child, and they would say, "Psokli psukayich, tell me what you learned today. What posik, what verse in the Torah and Tanakh did you learn today?" And they held that because a child has innocence, child is free from sin, so then whatever the child said was like a small prophecy. It was like it came from heaven. So the child said, the posik in Shmuel, "Nate lecho al yemincho o al smolcho." David HaMelech, either go left or go right. That was the posik. So he said, "Okay." So he said to his servant, "We cannot go on this road anymore because of the fact of what the child told me, so we'll go either left or we'll go right," and they avoided the pit that was dug for him. So the Talmud is replete with these stories regarding Rav Sheshis, who has this innate ability, even though he is physically sightless, to see more than people who are still blessed with sight. Now, Rav Sheshis was a person that we find in the Talmud, for instance, that every 30 days he was able to review all of the Torah that he knew. He reviewed it every 30 days. And since he was sightless, so it was by memory. It said on the Rogatchover Gaon, Yosef Rosen, who died in the 1930s, who also had this type of a memory, this type of a genius, that every 30 days he reviewed the entire Babylonian Talmud over and over again. So they told that to his compatriot in Dvinsk, in Latvia. Dvinsk was a smaller community of Jews, and it had these two great giants as being the rabbis in the town. It was a small pond with two great whales in it. And so they told the Or Sameach, they told Reb Meir Simcha, that the Rogatchover is such a genius. He knows Kol HaTorah Kula, he remembers everything. So Reb Meir Simcha says he didn't remember everything, he just learned it. Not because every 30 days he reviewed the entire Talmud. So that was what the Gemara says that on Rav Sheshes, that every 30 days he reviewed everything that he had. Rav Sheshes is the author of the statement in the Talmud that someone that is a gambler, a masachik bekuvia, somebody who plays with dice, that's a gambler, cannot be accepted as a witness. So the Gemara wants to know why. So he said, "Mishenu misasek bi yeshuvo shalolam." That's not a productive occupation. He's not helping the world thereby, and that was his method of measuring the standards of people. Are they advancing the cause of Torah? Are they advancing the cause of humanity? Are they advancing the cause of civilization? Or are they just wasting their lives? So he said, anyone that just wastes his life by being a gambler why should I believe his testimony? Obviously, he doesn't care, because otherwise he wouldn't behave in such a fashion. Rav Sheshes is not afraid to argue with anyone. He puts his opinion. We don't find that Rav Sheshes is like Rav Nachman would withdraw his opinion, or he would say, you know, I don't want to argue with the greater people, or I'm willing to hear what others say. Rav Sheshes, again, because of his personality, is much stronger than that. And therefore, we find throughout the Talmud this strength of character. Rav Sheshes has many, many students. Rava, I mentioned, is one of his students. And again, because of the fact that Rava was a student of Rav Nachman, but he was also of Rav Sheshes, and because of the fact that he also lived a long life. So these people, the great people that live long lives, have many generations of students. And therefore their influence extends over very long periods of time. We find that in the Talmud, but we find it in our time as well. People, for instance, Rabbi Soloveitchik had generations of students, Rabbi Aaron Cutler had generations of students, many, many other great people had generations of students, and because of that, so then they are able to really have influence far beyond their years, far beyond their years. Rav Nachman is the rationalist. We find that in Agoda. And Rav Sheshes, as we said, is this miracle worker. So they represent two different streams of thought. The Talmud says, for instance, that if you have two people that eat together on Shabbos, so Shabbos is the third person, and you can say Birchat HaMazon with a mezumen. And Rav Nachman says, V'chi Shabbos Gavrahu, Shabbos is a human being. Where'd you get that? You need three people. Shabbos is not a person. And we find the same thing. The Gemara has an opinion that if there are nine people and an Oren Kodesh with a Sefer Torah in it, so that counts for a minyan. So Rav Nachman says, is an Oren Kodesh a person? The Oren Gavra, who? You need 10 people that are, you know, can get up and walk and breathe. And therefore, he says, is the Oren Kodesh a person? Because again, the idea that's expressed is a supernatural idea. And he brings it down to the natural world. And the famous statement, the Talmud says, Vayichi Yaakov. Yaakov lived. So the Gemara says, Mabona b'chayim, afu b'chayim, Yaakov never died. So Rav Nachman said, so then why did they embalm him and bury him and put him away if he never died? So again, the idea of the Gemara is clear that Yaakov still lives because the Jewish people live. But his idea is also clear that what it says in the Torah, that's what it says. And you can't do violence to what it says by giving esoteric explanations to the matter. Rav Nachman said that they used to let blood, right? We discussed that, leeches, etc. So therefore, they held that on the day that a person let blood, he had to have a good meal. So he used to tell his students on the day that they let blood, they should go home and tell their wives that Rav Nachman is coming for dinner. So if Rav Nachman is coming for dinner, they'd have a good meal ready. And he said that even though he's not coming for dinner, but he said this type of exaggeration, so to speak, is permissible because it brings harmony in the house, saves a whole fight, because otherwise he'd come home and say, well, I want a steak tonight. She said, I'm busy. What do you need a steak for? You know. So he told her, Rav Nachman's coming. Oh, Rav Nachman's coming, you know, then we're going to have a meal. His description, Rav Nachman's description of the Talmud is a great description. He said it's a forest that keeps on growing new trees. So it's a great forest, and new trees are always present and always being planted. Part of the idea is that you have to be able to see the forest and not just the trees. Because many times in the Talmud, you take the little thing and spend time studying it, which is very important, but you don't see the whole rekka, you don't see the whole background for it, you don't see the whole framework for it, and you're unable, therefore, to deal with it. Finally, Rav Nachman said, G'dola aveira lishma mimitzvah shalo lishma. An aveira that's done for the sake of heaven. For instance, Yoel, when she seduces Sisera, so the Gemara calls that an aveira lishma. She did a sin, but she did it for the sake of God. Is greater, he said, than doing a mitzvah when you don't really mean it. An insincere mitzvah is less than a sincere sin, so to speak. And that was Rav Nachman's opinion, as mentioned in the Talmud. So we see these two great people, the second generation of Amoraim, who also marched together throughout the Talmud and are really our fathers in the study of Torah and in the tradition of Torah Shebaal Peh.